Everybody, and welcome to another episode of Every Horror Movie on Netflix, the podcast where we watch, review, and discuss every horror movie on Netflix. I'm Patrick, and I'm back, as always, with Allison with a Y.
Hello.
And Allison with an I.
Hey, hey, hey.
And we are here today to discuss Mononoke, the movie, Phantom in the Rain. This was my pick from our last episode. This is an anime that takes place during Japan's Edo period, when the country was ruled by shoguns. Our protagonists are Asa and Kame, two young women who are joining the Oku, a massive harem of women who act as servants and concubines to the feudal lord Tenshi. Asa and Kame react differently to life at the Oku, which requires them to sacrifice their sense of self and the things they've held dear. While Asa fits in more naturally and is quickly promoted into leadership roles at the Oku, Kame is well-meaning but clumsy. The two women form a close bond, with Asa supporting Kame. Meanwhile, strange happenings are afoot at the Oku. A celebratory festival for the birth of Lord Tenshi's child is postponed for mysterious reasons. The women of the Oku experience strange visions, and some high-ranking Oku staff are killed. A sly medicine seller attributes this to a vengeful spirit called a Mononoke. To free the Oku of the Mononoke's influence, he sets out to learn its identity, what it wants, and why it appeared in the first place. So that's our synopsis of Mononoke, and as we were discussing briefly before we started recording today, it sounds like this was something that was helpful for all of us. I mean, it was helpful for me to understand the movie, because I was on Reddit, I was on websites trying to confirm that what I had processed of as the plot of the movie was in fact the objective, like, truth of what I had seen in the movie. It sounds like from what y'all were saying, you kind of needed the backup as well.
Yeah. I did, yeah. Allison with an I here. I was confused for a lot of it. We can get into the reasons why, but yeah, I had a hard time following the plot. It was a lot. Why? What do you think?
Oh, I got it all without the written synopsis. However, I don't know if I could have articulated that. It took such intense concentration the entire time watching it to follow it. I mean, to the point where it was like kind of exhausting to concentrate really hard on it. It wasn't a casual watch by any means. It felt like I was studying.
That's a great way to put it, yeah.
And like, let's dig into some of the reasons why. Because, I mean, so for starters, this is based on a series. So there's 12 episodes of an anime series that precede the events of this movie. So there's already like some context we're missing. From my understanding, though, this like medicine seller character is kind of the constant. He's like an investigator who runs through each episode. And I think it is very episodic. So I don't know how much plot detail we're necessarily missing, but there is some previous context. What else? There's a lot that's kind of like overwhelming you with this movie, right?
Right. Just like, I mean, the visuals are, let me start by saying, absolutely stunning.
Mm-hmm. Oh my God.
But just incredible, incredible, but also so much to take in, because there is so much happening in every, I mean, quote, shot that's taking place. And I know the struggle for me, at least, with like having to concentrate so hard on it was because we watched it in the original Japanese with English subtitles, was like trying to read it. And because the dialogue was also so fast paced a lot of the time. So that's going quickly. So I'm trying not to miss any of that. But I'm also trying to not miss any of the visuals, because there's also really important context happening within the visuals as well that adds to the story. It was a little overwhelming and challenging in that sense.
Well, and the visuals are so fast-paced, too. Like the it borders on frenetic editing style. And that's not a criticism either. Like, I admired the kind of visual language of the film, but there's just a lot going on. There's a lot to take in. And as you said, there's a lot of sort of visual symbolism going on too, where stuff is being communicated without being said. Yeah, there's a lot to take in upon first viewing.
Yeah, I think this was one of the most visually beautiful movies I've ever seen in my entire life. I do feel like there was so much for me that was lost in translation. Like, I think that I don't, A, have, like, anime literacy as much as I would have liked to going into this movie. I don't obviously speak Japanese. I watched an English dubbed version with closed captioning on. And the closed captioning I neglected to put on in the first 5 minutes and was like, I've already missed. I have no idea what's going on. So I had to like put the closed captioning on, go back and restart the movie. I can't imagine having watched it in Japanese while trying to hear one language, read in another. And then these visuals that are happening are so beautiful, so chaotic, but borderline distracting, right? Like, I would have loved to see this film with just, like, beautiful instrumental music over it and, like, take some mushrooms. You know what I mean? Yeah. As far as understanding any sort of plot line, I was like, this is so much sensory stuff at once.
Yeah, I was thinking this is a movie that would benefit maybe from at least three watch-throughs, like your first one, just to try and soak it all in. Second one to really nail down some of the plot elements and some of the just visual elements and symbolism that you missed the first time around. And then a third time, psychedelics. Like this, this screams to be watched on some kind of substance.
Yeah. Oh,
like with the muted with your favorite like trippy album over it.
Yeah. Because the art style, I mean, we've all kind of nodded towards this having an interesting art style. It has a lot of your traditional kind of anime character design, but there's a lot of visual nods, I want to say, to the era that the movie is set in, which is sometime between the 1600s and 1800s, which is a broad range, obviously, but still gives you an idea of just how long ago this movie takes place. And it looks, to some degree, like traditional Japanese art of that time, but then also just insanely vibrant colors, like one of the most colorful movies I've ever seen, and not in a garish way. Very tasteful, masterful use of color, but just overwhelming, an overwhelming feast for the senses.
And also just like full of texture. Like that was one of the first things I remember thinking when we put this film on. I was like, oh my god, the texture in this is so full. It adds so much and makes it feel more alive, which was incredible. But I loved the colors, and I loved how it was so vibrant, but there was also like a softness to how vibrant it was too, which made it feel very like delicate and beautiful.
Agreed. Visually. Yeah, agreed. Totally agreed. How do they make movies like this?
That's a good question. I was kind of wrestling with it a bit myself while I was watching it because, you know, Allison with a Y alluded to texture. And I feel like you were talking about, like, you can see what seems to be, like, the texture of paper in these, in these scenes. And I'm not sure if that's a digital effect that was intentionally added to give it a hand-drawn, hand-created kind of aesthetic. Because there's certainly some digital animation in this as well, these kind of really fast shots through the palace you can tell are digital. But there's other stuff where I'm like, this looks very organic and the work of a human hand, but I'm not sure if it actually is or not. It's wonderful to behold and also kind of mystified me.
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine, regardless of how it was made, just one frame at a time, there was so much detail.
Yes.
Like, let's say the whole thing was computer generated. None of it was, you know, like animated by a human. Holy shit. It must have taken forever to make, or just the Japanese are better than us at everything, which is true. that always is true. But it was one of the most beautiful films I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah. Stunning, stunning detail everywhere you look. I mean, fuck, you could pause this at any frame, especially if you are on psychedelics with your favorite album playing in the background, and probably just zone out, have a great time. Clearly, we're all kind of on the same page, I think, about the visuals then, but we talked about the fast pace. I mean, for me, it worked, even though it was a little exhausting and felt like they were trying to crush like multiple TV episodes into this movie, which is the first of a trilogy, by the way. The second one is teased at the end. Clear that there's a plan for two more movies because there are some characters in this where it's like, why did we spend this much time with these characters? And I think it's because they're coming back in the later movies. I think we all felt that sort of exhaustion from watching it, but was it good exhaustion? Was it bad exhaustion? Was it somewhere in between?
There were almost too many players on the field for me. Mm. Like, too many players all at once. And it did feel like it was implied that we should know a little something before we watch this that I was not in the know about. Like, it introduced characters at such a rapid pace that had roles to play that were not fleshed out for me before I could understand what they were doing. And then by the time you do, or even if you don't, there's three more people. That felt too chaotic for me.
Right. We're introduced to a lot of members of the staff at the Oku. We're introduced to some of the like top concubines, top housemaids at the Oku. We're introduced to these couple of guys who are there, I believe, on behalf of the Shogun to kind of look into what's going on at the Oku. Yeah, there's a lot going on. There are a lot of characters. And it almost seems like there's some kind of setup for something epic. Like, this should have been the first 2.5 hour chapter of, you know, an 8 hour saga or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I liked the pacing, but yeah, it was just very dense. I just remember sitting there watching it and being like, okay, like, I need to be so focused in on this and remember who all of these people are and what their like relevance is. And I managed to like do that, but like I said before, it was very exhausting. Mm-hmm. But I did like how much it clipped along. It's just the movie was only an hour and a half.
Yeah, it was a clean 90 minutes.
Yeah. They were fitting a lot of information in there.
I gave up on figuring out who everyone was, and I was like, I'm gonna take this for what it is and look at it as a whole and just talk to the group about it, and maybe they can help me understand a little bit better what the hell I just watched.
Right, like, you can tell Asa and Kame are very important and people to latch on to, and the medicine seller clearly are all important characters, and kind of outside of that, there actually isn't a lot that you have to keep close tabs on.
Fair.
There are a couple of Mononoke victims, elder staff, kind of these matrons who run the handmaids. I forget their exact names, but there were two characters who were in positions of control over the handmaids who I had trouble distinguishing between. But it didn't really matter in the end.
Yeah. The Aunt Lydia's of it all.
That rings a bell, and I'm not connecting the reference.
Oh, it's Handmaid's Tale reference.
Oh, right, right. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, and speaking of the Handmaid's Tale, there's a lot going on in this movie politically and thematically, I think, too. And you don't have to be Japanese or necessarily have an intense understanding of Japanese history to appreciate it.
Yeah. You know, obviously, we mostly see women in the story. And it's interesting, especially like the older women, how much they uphold the system and how essential they are to upholding the system and the order to make the man's life easier.
Mm-hmm.
Ugh.
Yeah, right. And then, like, you know, you have the women who are the disruptors who don't last long there because they don't fit the order to be quiet and pleasing and subservient.
Right. Even Kame is honestly on board and excited about this whole thing.
Oh, she's stoked.
And I mean, she wants essentially money and status out of the whole thing, which is fair. But she's still, you know, a little bit of a doofus. She can't quite keep up with the work and stuff that she's supposed to do. And everybody treats her like shit for it, except for Asa, basically, who, you know, they form this friendship.
I liked Kame's character a lot. I feel like I empathized with her. First off, I think in every life that I've ever lived, I'm far too feminist to ever pursue that kind of a life. So let that be known. But Kame was very, very human. You know, mm-hmm. she was clumsy. She slept in. She didn't know how to make breakfast for 100 people. She had rose-colored glasses. She was very sweet. Very, very endearing. And you know what? They didn't deserve her. So
no. No, she was a sweetie.
She was sweet, and she brought so much energy to the story, which I really loved and appreciated about her. And I like what a difference she has to Asa. And I think they're both really good characters, because mm-hmm. Asa, she has like other very good qualities that you find in women who challenge the system, where she leads with empathy and compassion and softness. And that's not something that she compromises. And she makes a great leader and a natural leader because of that, which does also challenge the system, because a system like that isn't meant to run on that much empathy and compassion. Otherwise, you are putting the needs of those who are supposed to be subservient up higher than the system wants those needs to be met. And so I love the softness Asa had for Kame. Mm-hmm. Even though Kame was obviously not the brightest, Asa saw the good in her and believed in her and wanted to help her, while also maintaining her own boundaries and will as well, which I really liked about her.
Yeah, agreed. And I think Asa saw something in Kame that she not envied, but that she really appreciated. You know, like we kind of hear that towards the end of the movie. I don't know. It sounds a little bit more like Asa has led maybe a more refined life, and she's sort of been primed for this position a bit better than Kame was, but that she really respects and admires Kame's like childlike spirit, right? Mm-hmm. And her ability to just like laugh and giggle and be a girl. So I thought the two complemented each other really well. They made like a great little duo.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I agree.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a really strong central duo. To the degree that when the next installment of this trilogy comes out, I feel like the setup is kind of indicating that it's not going to continue following them. It's probably going to be more the medicine seller going on to do something else, perhaps. But I would like to see more of them and see what happens to them next.
Me too.
You've talked earlier about the historical context, and I do have to say that that's another place that I felt illiterate, right? Like, I'm not familiar with Japan in between the 16 and 1800s. I feel like you have more experience with anime and manga, and you've been to Japan. So like those things alone, you have, you know, some legs up on me. But what did you mean? What did you take from the historical context within the imagery that I might have missed?
So I don't have a deep knowledge. I don't have much knowledge at all, actually, of this period either. I think more what I was trying to say was just, even though I was ignorant of how Japan's social structure worked at that time, I still felt like I got a lot out of this as a social commentary. And I don't know, you probably get even more out of it if you are either Japanese or well-versed in Japanese history. But it still felt relevant and impactful to me, even though, you know, my knowledge of that is actually not much more, if any, than yours.
Okay, fair.
Yeah.
Did you guys think it was scary?
I don't know about scary. It was stressful, outside of, like, the trying to understand it. The story was a little stressful at times. I definitely felt, like, the tension being built up. But I don't think I found it scary, no. What did you think about that, Ai?
I think it was spooky. There were some moments that were spooky that I think we'd have to save for the spoiler room. Mm-hmm. But definitely not scary. I would say unsettling. And not until we figure a little more out about what's going on and like the reason for the Mononoke being there. I wasn't scared, but I was creeped out.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's unnerving. There's a lot of surreal kind of moments in this. You know, there are a lot of the time you see a crowd of the handmaids who live in the oku, and their faces will all be the same spiral pattern. They don't have facial features. It's just a spiral, which is never explained. And I can only assume it's showing them as sort of cogs in the machine, you know, compliant parts of this system. And it's very unsettling.
Yeah, I was going to ask what you guys made of swirly faces, because I made some guesses, but what was your thought on that? Why?
It was definitely creepy, but I also interpreted it as like these, when they have that, they are kind of faceless, just another body there to serve without a personality of their own and wants and needs of their own.
Yeah, they almost felt like enchanted to me, like they were under some sort of spell or like cult-like.
Yes. Very cult-like.
Yeah.
Big cult vibes in this movie, honestly.
Yeah. Well,
big cult energy.
Yes.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's a lot. I mean, obviously, there's sort of a ghost that drives this story. It is a ghost story. But outside of that, I was just, there's a lot of horrifying shit that happens in this movie. The handmaids do a little ceremony every day where they drink water from a big ceremonial well, and they talk about how the water tastes rancid, which was enough to kind of set, you know, the hairs on the back of my neck a-tingling long before we actually realized or learned why the water was rancid.
I knew there was something off about that water.
Yeah.
That... I mean, obviously, we'll save it for the spoiler room, but what was true was my guess.
Yeah. Well, and I think you could say that of the kind of the twist in general. I was not terribly surprised by the revelation.
Same.
And even interestingly, on the note still of horror, I love the interesting, completely unique sort of visual language that this movie comes up with to communicate basic concepts like smells that you cannot get across, or are very hard usually to get across in a movie. Like early on in the film, Kame brings a box of rice balls to share with everybody at the oku when she first starts there. Everybody's talking about how yummy they are, and there's this unique little visual symbol that kind of flies off of the rice balls, indicating the smell of them.
I didn't realize that was scent.
And it's like a good scent, and it's used in a couple other places. And then when they indicate the water is rancid, there's a different little symbol used to indicate the nasty smell of the water.
Wow. That looks like a radioactive symbol.
It does, yeah.
They use those through lines to talk about smell. Yeah, I was going to say the same thing.
And I loved that little bit of just, you know, visual language essentially invented for the movie that, you know, worked for me really effectively to make me actually feel the rancid smell of the water, even though I wasn't, in fact, smelling it, of course. I loved that.
Yeah, I love that too, Patrick. I'm glad you brought that up.
And there's a lot of other interesting kind of visual language that recurs throughout this. There's a lot with umbrellas. There's a lot about rain and depicting rain. There's this doll that we see over and over again. There's so much, again, imagery where you're reading almost as much out of visuals as you are reading dialogue, I guess. That might be a stupid statement, but there's just a lot to parse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think all in all, not understanding what the fuck was going on for most of the movie, I really did appreciate it. Mm-hmm. I mean,
yeah,
talking with you guys specifically, it helps me to appreciate it a little bit more because, you know, I'm processing it a little bit differently.
Yeah, it's something that I think works on just sort of a visceral level. Even if you're not comprehending the story, you know, if your brain is struggling to keep up, just let it switch off and take in whatever it actually takes in, and you're probably still going to find something to admire here. But yeah, I mean, having taken this all in, even though I was kind of overwhelmed by it, I really want to see the series. I watched one episode of the series, which I enjoyed. The animation is not as high quality as this. It's a similar art style, it's not as well executed, I would say. It just reeks of having less budget to work with, basically. But I was still really captivated by it, and I want to watch the rest. And I will definitely check out the other two when they come out. Would you guys look into the series, or would you want to watch any more of the movies?
I would be intrigued to watch more of the movies. I don't know if I would watch the series.
Yeah.
So my daughter Ella and I are in, we just started a new show, and it's my first real foray into consistent anime. So we're watching, she's rewatching, I'm watching for the first time, Hunter Hunter.
Oh yeah.
It's got like 20 seasons. It's insane.
Welcome to anime.
Oh my God.
There's way too much of everything.
That, as a contrast, I feel is so much more digestible, so much more understandable. You know, I think it's got a bigger age, you know, demographic than I think this movie did. So I'm kind of in anime land right now. I think I would put somewhere in my list in my life to watch, actually, maybe the series of this. Is it just Mononoke, the series?
Or? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And actually, okay, that one is short. That's just 12 episodes, which are also on Netflix right now.
Yeah, I think I would watch that. I don't know that I would. If I felt like I were equipped after watching that with like a lot more information and able to keep up with the pacing a little bit better, like if that primed me for it, I might watch the movies. But Allison with a Y, I agree with you. This took a lot. It was a hard watch for me. It was a challenge. So I'm not sure.
Fair.
I feel like with that, we're sort of on the brink of reviewing it. Allison with an I, do you want to just move straight into your view it, cue it, or screw it for this movie?
Yeah, I don't have like a lot of conviction on how I would rate this movie. It's hard for me to either recommend or not recommend this movie because I don't think I'm the right person to do that. Like, again, my literacy for this is really low. I guess it would depend on who I was talking to, you know? Mm-hmm. If I were talking to someone who was super into anime and they had more experience with it, I think I would view it. If I were talking to just another person that likes horror, I think I would screw it. Not screw it, fuck it, damn it, but just, I'm not going to task somebody with this. It's a heavy load to carry. So, you know, I guess for the sake of giving it some kind of rating, it's probably a screw it for me. Unless, caveat, you put it on, you take some mushrooms, and you expect to understand nothing about the film. In which case, view it for sure. What about you, Patrick?
This is a big view it for me. I understand that it would probably be challenging for some viewers and not everyone's cup of tea, but I just think it's kind of an astonishing work of art. It is a little frenzied, and I'm curious to see if that sort of frenziedness pays off in terms of the story that it seems like they have remaining to tell in the two other movies when those come out. That's part of my curiosity about watching them. But like I said before, I think it's a movie where if you go in and frankly don't even understand anything about the story, the characters, just the plot as a total what the fuck just happened, I think it's still just fascinating to behold on a visual level. And even for a horror fan, if you want to just turn, say if you were to mute the audio entirely, don't even try to make sense of the plot, there's still really unsettling visuals to unpack here. Even if it may not seem like it in the early going because it's just like colorful people at a palace. It's fascinating. It's one of the weirdest, strangest, most beautiful things that I've seen in a bit and certainly that I've seen in Amon history. So view it for me. Allison with a Y.
I'm right split down the middle. I'm a cue it. I think similarly to I feel like if you're an anime person, it's an absolute view it, no question. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it's for everyone. Mm-hmm. And I don't think everyone would appreciate it. It wouldn't be something that a horror fan would inherently appreciate. So that's what gives me kind of pause and puts me in more of a cue it range. That being said, you know, like I really did enjoy it. It was a lot of work. And I would say for the casual viewer, just be kind of prepared for the fact that if you want to know what's going on, you really, really need to pay very close attention. If you really want to follow the story. But yeah, cue it.
And probably still miss stuff.
And probably still miss plenty of stuff, because Lord knows I did.
Yeah.
And I was focusing.
All right, well, we, you know, there's nowhere we can go today other than the spoiler well. We're going down the well to reveal all the spoilers about Mononoke, the movie, Phantom in the Rain. But before we head down there, I will remind you, as always, to visit our website, everyhorrormovieonnetflix.com, which I am so fucking pleased to announce, after years of jokes, is no longer broken. If you go to that link, it'll redirect you to our podcast host website for the podcast, which has everything you need. All the Amon episodes are out there. There's a link to our merch store where you can get shirts and other goodies with Amon art on them. And there's a link to our Discord where we have a really lovely community of folks from all over the world discussing horror movies in general, as well as those that we watch on the podcast.
You can also find us at Facebook, Instagram, Blue Sky, YouTube at AmonCast, and then on TikTok, which will still be around for a little while, I guess.
73 more days.
Amon Podcast, EHMON Podcast.
And also find us on your podcast provider of choice and leave us a review. We love to see the feedback and it helps people find the show. All right, everybody got your rice balls, your combs, your everything you need to go down the spoiler well?
Yep.
All right. We'll see you there in just a minute to spoil everything about Mononoke, the movie, Phantom in the Rain. All right. We are back. We're down in the spoiler well to spoil everything about Mononoke. And, you know, the first spoiler is just that down here in the well with us, there's a lot of fucking corpses.
Mm-hmm. A lot of dead ladies.
It turns out that basically if you sort of step out of line or don't perform well at the Oku, you get dismissed, except getting dismissed is not just you get sent home. They throw you down the fucking well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The well with the water that they're insisting the handmaids drink from every day not to, quote unquote, dry out. Yuck.
Yeah.
The famously rancid water we were discussing before. And this all kind of ties into the Mononoke itself, which the medicine man discovers is a manifestation of the spirit of Kitagawa, who used to be a scribe at the Oku, who has appeared to... It's Asa, right? And as a ghost.
Yeah, but basically. I don't think Asa realized she was a ghost.
No, she didn't. Yeah,
when she appeared to her.
Right. But I think that was one plot detail that I think none of us had too much trouble sort of piecing together.
Yeah.
It became clear to me pretty quickly that there was something off with Kitagawa, and she probably had something to do with the Mononoke.
Yeah, because Kitagawa was also, there was a clear correlation between Kitagawa and this like little doll that kept coming back into the story.
And it turns out that that was her prized possession. All the handmaids at the Oku have to pick out their most prized possession and throw it in the well at the beginning of their time at the Oku to symbolize letting go of their past life. In Kame's case, this is first her box of rice balls that we mentioned before, and then also a comb as well, right?
That was her grandmother's.
Right, yeah. So she throws two things in.
Yeah, there was that moment where she threw the comb in where everyone tried to stop her. I didn't understand any of that. Did you guys make anything of that? Like, is it because she had already thrown in the rice balls?
I think because they thought that the rice balls weren't really sufficient.
Mm.
I thought that she had been kind of chastised for the rice balls, that being the offering or whatever.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And it was like her trying
to prove
herself.
Well, she didn't throw in the rice balls.
No, well, no, she didn't, I guess.
That's true.
One of the old matrons who like runs the show, you know, Kame is trying to be nice and hand out her rice balls, and the old lady just takes the whole box of balls and throws it in the well, which was pretty rude.
Okay, so then the comb, her grandmother's comb, was her intentional offering of her fidelity, I guess. Okay. Yeah.
And this China doll that we keep seeing was Kitagawa's item that she threw into the well, which was holding an umbrella when it went in, and the umbrella came loose from the doll's hand as it falls. So this doll, with and without its umbrella, and also the umbrella separate from the doll, recur over and over again.
Yeah, that umbrella comes back a lot.
Symbolic imagery, yeah. And, you know, you could write a college paper, I'm sure, on the umbrella, its connection to rain and water and yada yada. There's plenty going on there.
Do you know what this reminded me of? And this was really, really dark, but in following true crime and Allison with a Y, I know that you do too. Remember the story about Alisa Lam?
Oh, God, that haunts me.
Oh, I know. No. But I got some flashbacks of that when we figured out that they were pushing these women down the well who tried to leave. Yeah. So, Patrick, and for our listeners who aren't familiar, and I hate to even talk about this because it's such a tragic story, but I had that thought. This Alisa Lam in 2013 traveled to LA to find herself and write and, you know, like be a free spirit in the midst of a really deep mental health crisis. And went missing. And the only reason that she was found was because the guests at the Cecil Hotel, which, by the way, has a totally sordid history. If anyone knows anything about the Cecil Hotel, it's like where dreams go to die.
It was the inspiration for the hotel season of American Horror Story.
Oh,
the Cecil Hotel. Not necessarily this story, but the Cecil Hotel.
Right,
itself.
The Cecil Hotel, yes.
Best AHS season, just to slip a hot take in the middle of this horrifying story.
I'm between that and Coven, always.
Oh, those are Coven my two favorite. Fun. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyhow, her body was found because the guests of the hotel started to complain that their drinking water was black and tasted rancid. And that enabled hotel workers and local police to check the water tanks on the roof of the hotel where she was dead. And had, I mean, huge mystery. How did she get there? There was ghost stories around this. There's video of her in an elevator, like peeking her head in and out as if she's talking to an apparition that you can't see. Whoa. It turned out that they decided she had a severe mental health crisis, got herself into the water tank, and drowned.
Yeah. That's fucked.
Yeah. What was so messed up about it, I think, was like kind of like the public response to it and how there were all these like, you know, kind of armchair sleuths and people going to the hotel to try and like figure it out themselves. But really, in reality, it was like even more sad because it was just like this woman's worst day of her life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That.
But I immediately thought of that when it turned out that the well was poisoned in this movie. The well was poisoned with the bodies of all of the women who tried to leave.
Yeah.
Right. Because in Kitagawa's case, she had a kind of clumsier friend, the way Asa has Kame. And basically, she kind of encouraged her friend to get out of the Oku. And as we said, you don't really just leave the Oku, you get thrown down the well. And so when Kitagawa discovered what happened to her friend, she killed herself by jumping into the well and is now haunting the whole place as this Mononoke.
Yeah.
So it's, again, not a shocking twist necessarily, and I don't know that it's meant to. It's not a mystery where a bunch of like red herrings are deployed or anything like that. It's not exactly a whodunit, but the emotional impact, I think, is very much there.
Yeah, I think you have a lot of empathy for Kitagawa. She's not, while like the Mononoke, you're like, what is going on with this spirit that is like, you know, targeting people? You know, the Mononoke also targets people who are cruel and who uphold the system and who have power in the system and use their power over people.
Right.
So it's just like, you know, I was on the Mononoke side personally.
Yeah. It definitely cleaned house. It definitely, I think, like purged the old ways and paved way for a refinement, you know, like some reform there, which then, you know, Asa takes the reins on that and decides to stay and kind of it's implied that she's going to usher in a new era of how things are done. And it needed to happen.
Yeah. And meanwhile, Kame can actually finally just leave. And she also gives up her perhaps Pollyanna-ish vision of what was going to happen to her and how her her future might change as a member of the Oku, and she actually leaves now that she has the freedom to do that. The medicine seller defeats the Mononoke in the trippiest fucking scene in the whole movie. Like, holy shit.
With the coolest music, too.
Amazing music. It's a killer fucking scene. It fits in a little weirdly with the rest of the movie, I feel. But I was so into it.
Yeah. I have a crush on that dude.
Yeah.
The medicine seller?
Yeah, totally.
I was going to say, he's very, like, obviously very, like, otherworldly, but I was into it. I was like, is he hot? He's kind of hot.
He's like androgynous and I don't know, wears cool makeup and like
has bangs.
Has bangs like stood out in a way that like he was marching to the beat of his own drum. That's for like, sure.
Very elfin features.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Know. Transforms in some interesting ways while fighting the Mononoke.
Yeah.
But yeah, the fight with the Mononoke is just this explosion of geometric shapes and colors and just incredible. I've never really seen a fight depicted this way. It reminded me of some of like the psychedelic old like Doctor Strange comics. The original Doctor Strange comics were very weird, and this felt like it would fit in with some of those. But I'm curious what y'all thought about that. You know, defeating this Mononoke, who, as we said, like, we all kind of relate to the Mononoke. I think most people watch this and would relate to the Mononoke's cause and empathize with her motive. So how did you read or react to that scene of her being vanquished or it being vanquished by this character that we also like?
I guess I read it as her being set free.
Mm-hmm.
Like no longer, you know, feeling the anger and the heartbreak and like the torture of that. So to me, it was like a relief, you know, not like a, oh, this evil entity is gone. It's like, oh, this person who was really hurt is now free from that pain.
It felt that way to me too. It felt like a symbolic sort of exposing her story and exposing the reality of the Oku, which was what was keeping her in the first place. Kind of classic ghost shit.
Yeah,
she was hanging around.
She had unfinished business.
Right, yeah. And the medicine seller is all about understanding. He's looking for, as he uses it, the terms in the movie are form, truth, and reason. And it's kind of a three-step process for him. He has to learn who the Mononoke actually is, what it wants, and why it even became a Mononoke in the first place. And I love that sort of procedural approach to understanding this phenomenon.
Yeah.
It was cool. Mm-hmm. It was cool. It was depicted in a very visual sort of action-packed way that felt like a fight. And so I reacted to it a little strangely at first because I was like, well, I don't want her to be killed, but I don't really think that's what it represents in the plot.
Yeah, I read it the same way. You know, it's implied that whether you're trying to do good by releasing a spirit or not, there's going to be some resistance, right? Mm-hmm. So like the fight was the resistance that the spirit had put up to make sure she broke it all down, you know, broke down the system, exposed the truth. And only then was she or it kind of free to be vanquished. I read it the same way as it was setting it free. In that way, it was lovely. I thought it was lovely.
Well, and speaking of setting things free, there's also an interesting moment here. Again, talk about things that are mostly just visual storytelling in this. As far as I recall, maybe I blinked my eyes or looked away for a second because I did fall asleep for the entire first time that I watched this movie. But then I went back and watched the entire thing fully awake. Just program note. But we never see what Asa throws in the well at the beginning, if anything, right?
Ooh, good point. Yeah. No, I don't think we do.
So.
And during the hallucinatory climactic events of this movie, there's this really interesting scene where Asa seems to be either jumping or falling down the well, and Kame grabs her hand as she falls. And then the perspective switches, it flips, so that Asa is now holding on to Kame and chooses to let go of Kame's hand, implying that Kame is the most important thing to her, and she has to let Kame go, which is why Kame leaves the Oku at the end. And that was one of the most emotional notes in the movie for me, was that Kame meant that much to Asa, and that was the biggest sacrifice for Asa, of staying at the Oku and trying to, you know, presumably spearhead some kind of reform, is letting her friend go her own way.
Whoa. I did not catch that.
Same.
I love it, though.
That just gave me chills, though.
I know.
Isn't it good?
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
That is beautiful, because she does. She says that thing like, all I really want is to like eat meals with Kame and just laugh and stay up late. Like, I think you're right. I mean, I think you are right. But man, that packs a punch.
There is closeness between these characters, and it verges on big sapphic energy. It may they may be platonic friends, but there's even some very, very close, like sleeping together, and I mean in the very holding hands while falling asleep together, and there's just a closeness here that almost seems to verge on something more than platonic.
There's a soul connection there. They just like instantly recognize each other as kindred spirits.
Bosom
friends.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Something that I wanted to talk about, which I didn't feel like was appropriate until the spoilers, is just like a very rudimentary, similar sort of notes to The Ring. Like someone being thrown down a well, turning into this, you know, ghostly presence seeking revenge. And at the end, you just find out it's because they were just like a hurt little girl. I thought that was very interesting. I'm like, is this, like, I wonder, does it go back to like an old Japanese legend? Because wasn't Ringu a Japanese film, the original?
Yep.
So I wonder if these are both inspired by like an old Japanese legend or something like that. Do either of you know anything about that?
I don't, but I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah, I don't know anything about the legend, but I hadn't thought about that until now. And that's a great parallel.
Yeah.
I don't think I would have thought about that had you not said it. There must be a lot of wells in Japan, first of all. Like deep, dangerous wells.
Yeah. All right. Well, it's time to figure out what we're watching for next episode. And it was my turn for this movie. So that means next up is The Wheel of Death. It's time for a random movie pick. And it always tends to pick something really fucked up. So we'll see what our Cyber Wheel of Death has for us today. We're gonna fire it up right now, get it spinning. All right, let's see. What do we got here? I'm a little scared.
Oh boy, let's see what it gives us.
Oh, I said classic Wheel of Death on our last Wheel of Death pick, and this is very much in the same vein. It's Nobody Sleeps in the Woods Tonight 2.
Two.
We are dropping into the middle of a franchise in classic Amon fashion. We are not going to watch Nobody Sleeps in the Woods Tonight 1 unless one of you has seen it already.
Can't say that I have.
Nope.
Me either. We are just going to watch 2 completely out of context, because sometimes that happens. Sometimes you're just at your friend's house. Somebody's like, let's see what this is. They throw something on Netflix and it's just, you deal with it. So,
all right, let's go.
The Netflix summary of this movie is... Julia Winyawa returns as Zosha, who may be at the center of what is terrorizing the locals of a small, out-of-the-way town.
Okay. So
we'll find out all about that next time. That's the blurb. It's always just like one sentence, at most two sentences. So we'll find out what that's all about next time. Maybe we'll also figure out how to pronounce Julia Winyawa's name. And that'll be next time on Every Horror Movie on Netflix. Until then, check out the website, everyhorrormovieonnetflix.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Blue Sky at Amoncast, EHMONcast. Follow us on TikTok at Amonpodcast, EHMONpodcast. And you can find a link to our Discord in the show notes. Until next time, I'm Patrick.
I'm Allison with a Y.
And Allison with an I.
We'll see you next time.